ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Israel's Security Cabinet votes in favour of a full military occupation of Gaza City. Also, another twist in the case of convicted triple murderer Erin Patterson, and celebrating little-known women and their role in Sydney's history.
I think that there is this real hunger for a different side of Sydney's story and to hear the stories of women and of people who don't usually see themselves reflected in the story of Sydney.
Israel is defying global calls for a ceasefire in the war in Gaza, with its security cabinet voting in favour of a full military occupation of Gaza City. The Israeli government says its goal is to achieve a decisive victory over Hamas and to retrieve the remaining 50 hostages. Mr. Netanyahu's plan goes against the recommendations of the Israeli military and has angered the families of the hostages. Diana Damjanovic has more.
Blasts of light and smoke rise over the night sky. It comes as another chapter in this war appears ready to begin. Israel's security cabinet has now approved a military occupation of Gaza City. Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to Fox News in the United States just before the decision.
In order to assure our security, remove Hamas there, enable the population to be free of Gaza and to pass it to civilian governance. That is not Hamas and not anyone advocating the destruction of Israel.
Israel says the military escalation is a way to end the war with Hamas, and it's released five goals it aims to achieve. They include the return of all 50 remaining Israeli hostages, 20 of whom are believed to be alive, and removing Hamas. Gus McLaughlin is a retired Army Major General with experience in the Middle East. He says if the Israeli military goes for full occupation, it will have to focus on two separate objectives at the same time.
It will be hunting a lethal insurgent force, which still remains, and it will be protecting, feeding, and providing health services to a population who have been displaced a number of times.
But the planned military occupation is already attracting criticism. The cabinet's approval is for occupation of Gaza City, whereas Benjamin Netanyahu has said he wants to occupy the entire territory of Gaza. Israeli media is reporting the Israeli Army's Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir, has told the Prime Minister a full occupation of Gaza would endanger the lives of 20 hostages who are believed to be alive, as well as of soldiers who are exhausted. Many of the hostages' families share those concerns. Gus McLaughlin.
Now, the Israeli military has a tradition of frank advice back to its government. It's a fairly fractious military. A lot of that is because they are drawn from the community. They're predominantly a reserve force. Now, they're a democracy. Ultimately, their military will do as they're told. But it is their advice about the difficulties is founded on the reality of what is in front of them.
Australia and the United Kingdom have warned against the move, while the US President Donald Trump says a decision on the full Gaza occupation is up to Israel. Alex Rivchin is the head of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. He says a military decision is needed.
You've had since the end of May an internationally brokered ceasefire on the table, which would have paused the fighting completely for 60 days, allowing much needed aid to flow into the right place and get to Palestinian civilians. This is what the international community was pleading for. This is what Israel accepted, but Hamas has refused it. And so unfortunately, with no diplomatic solution in sight, the only option appears to be military.
Ahmed Fawad Al-Khatib disagrees. He leads Realign for Palestine, which is part of the Atlantic Council. He says other options are possible.
I've spoken to Arab officials. I've spoken to international figures who want to come into Gaza and help facilitate a transitional period. but most are extraordinarily uncomfortable being to be seen as doing that on top, on the back of Israeli tanks. And so if you're not going to have the Palestinian Authority give its blessings, which is the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, regardless of how corrupt and out of touch and irrelevant it might seem, then no one is going to be really comfortable in being involved in this. And I worry immensely about this plan being something to facilitate the resettlement of Gaza per the fantasies of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir.
Ahmed Fa'ud Al-Khatib from Realign for Palestine, Diana Damjanovic with that report. For more on the decision of the Israeli Security Cabinet to back a full military occupation of Gaza City, I spoke to the ABC's Middle East correspondent, Alison Horn. Alison, can you explain for us how this proposed full military takeover of Gaza will be different to what's happening now?
Sam, currently Israel says it controls about 75% of Gaza. There are three main areas that it doesn't have military control over. Gaza City is one of them. So what will happen now is military troops and tanks are expected to converge on Gaza City and to take over control of that city, an area that they haven't operated in before, and an area that is currently sheltering up to 1 million displaced Palestinians who have fled from other areas across Gaza during this war. What makes this a little bit different and is why it's being seen as an escalation is Gaza City is really seen as the logistic and symbolic heart of Gaza. It's an area that the military hasn't really operated in before during this war, apart from one small period of time. So this is a major escalation, and Israel says it believes that the last remnants of Hamas are hiding out there, and also that the hostages are being held there. 50 hostages, 20 of whom are still alive, according to Israel, are believed to be held there. So this is what Israel says will be its final assault in anticipation of perhaps ending the war.
We certainly hope the hostages can be recovered, but has the Israeli government explained how it's planning to deal with those million or so Gazans who are in Gaza City?
No, no information yet. And I guess this is one of the major criticisms of this plan by aid and humanitarian groups. Where will these people go? They're people that have fled from all corners of Gaza into these small pockets that are not really habitable, but are, I guess, have been less affected by the fighting and bombardment in other areas of the Strip. So there are two other small pockets that would be that these people could perhaps be moved to. But they're already so crowded and the facilities are there are already so overwhelmed, it doesn't quite seem feasible about moving these people to those small pockets. And then if you look more broadly across the Strip, they can't really be moved or go safely to the north of Gaza or right into the south of Gaza because there is still active fighting happening in those areas. Those areas have also been nearly completely demolished. So there is no information from Israel yet as to how it's going to facilitate the movement of these people. And that is one of the obligations that it does have as a military occupier within Gaza. It has to ensure, in accordance with international law, the safe passage of these Palestinians out of active fighting zones.
And I assume from what you're saying, the Israeli government hasn't given any information on any plans to get more aid to those people?
No, apart from saying that it will continue to ensure the provision of aid as it carries out this expansion of the military operations inside Gaza.
And how are the Israeli people reacting to this plan?
Well, already from a base, this is not a popular plan. They fear greatly for the safety of the hostages, and they cite an incident that happened about a year ago when Hamas received intelligence that the IDF was advancing through the southern Gazan city of Rafah, and it murdered six living hostages just hours before the IDF reached them.
Alison, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, says he wants Arab nations to eventually govern Gaza. How are those nations likely to react to his plan?
Well, already we've heard from Jordan, which would have to be one of the Arab nations, given that it's so close to Israel, shares a border with Israel. It's already said it won't be taking direction from Benjamin Netanyahu, and it says Arab nations won't be complying with the orders of the Netanyahu government.
Countries like the UK, France and Canada say they're going to recognise Palestinian statehood by September if certain conditions are met, and we know Australia is considering doing the same. How will this Netanyahu plan affect this, given the Israelis say they will have no Palestinian involvement in the government of the enclave?
I mean, if we didn't know it before, we know it even more certain now that it kind of spells the end of this proposal of a two-state solution. If there is no Palestinian involvement in the governance of Gaza, how can that be considered a Palestinian state? So by the countries like the UK, France, Canada, and potentially, who knows, even Australia by that stage, saying that they plan to recognise Palestinian statehood, it won't really change anything on the ground, but it may spur on more countries to throw their support behind the idea of Palestinian statehood and trying to give self-determinance to Palestinians in the hope that it would pressure Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right government back to the table to negotiate a longer-term peace agreement and a two-state solution. I think that's highly unlikely, though.
Alison Horne is the ABC's Middle East correspondent. Well, there have been more stunning revelations in the case of the so-called mushroom murderer, Aaron Patterson, today. After the lifting of a suppression order by the Victorian Supreme Court, we can now report that Ms. Patterson had been charged with the attempted murder of her estranged husband, Simon Patterson. He had fallen seriously ill on several occasions after eating food prepared by her in 2021 and 22. That information was never put to the jury in her recent trial, which ended with her convicted of murdering Mr. Patterson's parents and aunt and the attempted murder of his uncle. The attempted murder case relating to Mr. Patterson would have been run separately. And while prosecutors haven't revealed why the case was dropped, legal commentators believe they most likely made the decision because they thought they had a better chance of getting convictions in the murder case against Ms. Patterson. For more on the latest chapter in this notorious case, I spoke to ABC court reporter Christian Silver. Christian, there were several incidents in 2021 and 22 where Simon Patterson got sick after eating food prepared by his wife. What happened on those occasions?
That's right, Sam. So Simon Patterson claimed that he'd eaten a penne pasta, a chicken korma curry and a vegetable wrap, all prepared by Aaron Patterson in and around trips that the two of them went on, camping trips in 2021 and 2022. And he said that on those occasions when he ate that food, he got quite sick. On one occasion, actually, he ended up in a coma in hospital and needed life saving surgery, and there was a very lengthy recovery. So this was all in the lead up to the fatal lunch. I think one thing that's interesting that came out from the pretrial hearings is that we learned that, you know, Simon Patterson did have suspicions, but he just didn't think Aaron Patterson would target other people.
Christian, tell us more about how sick Simon Patterson actually got on those occasions. I understand he actually had part of his bowel removed in an operation.
That's correct. I mean, this was incredibly serious. Part of his bowel removed, and their doctors could not figure out what had made him so sick. Later on in the pre-trial, the prosecution flagged a theory that it was possible that rat poison may have been the source of one of the illnesses, but I stressed that that was an allegation that was not tested before a judge or a jury. It was something that the defence was absolutely going to contest. And ultimately, what happened was the prosecution dropped attempted murder charges in relation to Simon Patterson.
Now, Erin Patterson told the court at her trial that she had been drying mushrooms and using them in cooking. Do we know if there were mushrooms in the food that allegedly made Simon Patterson sick on those three or so occasions?
We don't know. Really. And I think it's going to be a matter of speculation to wonder what could have been in them. One thing, though, that is interesting, because Simon Patterson had flagged with a very small group of people his concerns that Erin was trying to poison him, one of which was a doctor. When the lunch guest fell really sick and ended up in hospital, the hospital was tipped off very early by a concerned doctor that what had happened to Don and Gail Patterson and Heather and Ian Wilkinson was not an accident. So it was something that allowed the medical staff to very quickly look for sources of poison. So on that occasion, they were able to find the death cap mushroom poisoning source a lot quicker.
Yes, I think some of the documents released today, Christian, actually reveal that Simon Patterson had confided in a doctor that he thought his wife might be poisoning him. Is that correct?
He did. He actually started tracking his meals in a spreadsheet. And it was only after the fatal lunch, when four people had fallen gravely ill, that he called together a much larger group of his extended family. And we heard in the pre-trial, that is when he told them that he feared that Erin had actually been responsible for his illnesses and that she may have been responsible for what happened to the four who went to her house for lunch.
Yes, Christian, the court heard in the trial that Simon Patterson told his wife that he didn't feel comfortable going to the lunch back in July 2023. So it seems we can now infer that the actual reason was he feared she was trying to poison him. So getting back to a point you raised earlier, why didn't he tell his parents and uncle and aunt that it might be wise not to go to what ended up being the infamous Beef Wellington lunch?
I'm sure this is something that plays over in his head every day. I'm sure it's something he thinks about. But, we heard in the pre-trial that he didn't fear that she would target anybody else. I think he wasn't aware of Erin ever having done this to anyone else. And what we learned even through the trial itself and what the jury heard was that Simon Patterson believed that Erin loved his extended family. She had a close relationship with his parents. She was involved in the church community, and he just had no reason to suspect that anything would happen to anyone else.
Christian Silver is an ABC court reporter, and the pre-sentencing hearing for Erin Patterson will be held later this month. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Australia's privacy watchdog is suing Optus over the 2022 cyber attack that compromised the data of more than 9 million Australians. Cyber experts predict the case will change the way companies deal with their customers' information. The Office of the Australian Information Commissioner is alleging Optus failed to adequately manage and protect the personal data in the 3 years leading up to the breach. Here's our business correspondent, David Taylor.
Optus is still on the hook for its past sins. The Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, or the OAIC, has filed civil penalty proceedings in the federal court, alleging Optus breached privacy laws by failing to properly protect consumers' data. Richard Buckland is a professor of cybercrime at the University of New South Wales.
And now it looks like there's a shift, and the government and the regulator are stepping up and starting to be hard on companies and holding them to high standards and saying, you actually have to treat people's data with care.
The commissioner alleges that for a nearly three-year period until September 2022, when the cyber attack resulted in a breach, Optus, quote, seriously interfered with the privacy of approximately 9.5 million Australians. Optus did this, it says, by failing to take reasonable steps in relation to the Privacy Act to protect their personal information.
I don't know that it's all down to the cyber team. I think the cyber team actually did a really good job. I think it's down to the fact that they were set up, really. They were like the fire brigade and people were storing cans of petrol in the house. And the fire brigade did a great job when the house started burning. And you really have to ask, why were we storing that petrol in the house?
Do you think this could set a precedent just in terms of scaring the pants off other big companies and saying,
oh, 100%, 100%. This will change behaviour. There's nothing as strong a signal as this. It's changing community expectations. It's good to see the OAIC, the commissioner, the regulator, jumping in and doing something. There's been a really long period of time where there haven't really been strong penalties applied, just raps on the knuckles. So it's with this new focus and the size of this penalty, Yeah, I think it will change behaviours. I think there'll be discussions in boardrooms, and I think companies will be financing cyber teams better.
Optus could face a hefty fine, given the federal court can impose a civil penalty of up to $2.22 million for each contravention under the Act. Vanessa Teague is the CEO of Thinking Cybersecurity at the Australian National University.
If you remember, it was reported at the time that they had left the data up on an unauthenticated API, meaning they left it up on the internet in a way that really didn't have the most basic protections, not even a login and password kind of a thing. If that's true, and if that turns out to be a major factor in determining the payout, then it may only disincentivise that kind of flagrant irresponsibility and not necessarily have the effect we'd like it to have of disincentivising more ordinary, incompetent and irresponsible data practices.
Well, but this goes to the heart of the issue, I think, because we've seen over multiple years many companies failing to meet the standards that
exactly.
you'd expect from stakeholders. So what on earth is going to prompt companies? Are they worried about their bottom line? What's the issue here?
Well, that's kind of exactly the point, right? So they would only be incentivized to clean up their act if they believed, and I wish I believed, but I'm not sure I do, that there are going to be ongoing consequences for inadequate data protection, that the fines are large, that the enforcement is frequent, right? That not a one-off, but that the OAIC will frequently and strongly be able to go after irresponsibility, and that not only the most egregious cases are going to be sued.
An Optus spokesperson says the company is reviewing the proceedings.
David Taylor reporting. In the streets of our towns and cities, it's common to see prominent men immortalised with statues or streets named after them. But the stories of Australia's pioneering women are often little known. One group is trying to change that with guided walks in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra. Our reporter Millie Roberts joined one of the Sydney tours.
I think the rain is kind of easing enough that we can start sort of heading out.
On a rainy Sydney morning, a group gathers to learn about a city many of them have lived in for years. From Hyde Park to the historic Rocks area, a new walking tour is dedicated to celebrating the women who helped shape the city. Today's tour guide is Catherine Bendel.
I live in the Cross, so I drive down here 100 times a week, and until very recently I had no idea who that statue was. I just assumed it was the statue of Mary, the Mother of Christ. It's not. It's Australia's first saint. That's Mary MacKillop.
Catherine Bendel guides the tour around some of Sydney's key landmarks, like the Mint and Sydney Hospital, telling their stories along the way.
But I think she's going to set the tone for a lot of the women we're going to talk about today. And they are women who fought the system. By the way, she's known in the Catholic Church as the patron saint of troublemakers.
From Indigenous activists deeply involved in the 1938 day of mourning Pearl Gibbs to the godmother of Sydney Harbour Bridge Kathleen Butler, she sheds light on the women who have never gained the fame that their male counterparts received.
From a lot of the historical records that Elizabeth Macquarie had a huge impact. The sculptures of Lachlan Macquarie are pretty universally hideous. And seeing as we have one just there and then one just there, I've always wondered why we just didn't put Elizabeth Macquarie there.
The tour is run by a group called She Shapes History. It was founded by Sita Sargent after she became fed up with the patriarchal retelling of Australian history.
I think that there is this real hunger for a different side of Sydney's story.
Sita Sargent says She Shapes History does similar tours in Melbourne and Canberra.
These are stories of women that I truly believe every Australian should know, but that we were just never told.
One of those women was Millicent Preston Stanley, the first female member of New South Wales Parliament. Dr. Wendy Michaels is an academic and researcher who wrote a biography on Millicent Preston Stanley.
Once women had the right to vote in 1918, four women stood in 1920. None of them, of course, were elected. And then finally, in 1925, Millicent was elected 100 years ago. And it had been a long battle. You know, this battle for the vote and for women's rights began really in the 19th century.
And Dr. Michaels argues it's important to remember how challenging that role would have been for women of the time.
See, when she arrived in the Parliament, she wasn't even given an office in the Parliament. She was put in the annex. And even one gentleman said how unfair that was, but she had to run 5 minutes if the bells rang, and she had to get in for a vote.
Biographer Dr. Wendy Michaels, Millie Roberts with that report. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joram Toth, David Sargent and Nick Drakoulis. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump didn't like the numbers, so he sacked the messenger. So what are the implications of the US president's decision to get rid of the nation's chief statistician who dared to release revised job figures? Today, staff writer at The Atlantic, Tom Nichols, on the sledgehammer Trump is taking to democracy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.